penultimate session of this conference, which is on performance and text. And we will have one to three speakers between now and the coffee break. And the first is Dr. Lisa Owen. Lisa, there you are. And she also got a degree from the University of Texas, where we all teach. And we are so proud to have our own students here. And she will speak on absence and presence, worshiping the Jinnah at Ellora. Lisa. And I will sort of give you a 5-minute warning.
Okay,
here.
Sounds good. All right, thank you. Yeah, I think it's the lights down, I'm proud to say that I'm an art historian, so visuals will be used throughout the 20-minute presentation. I'd like to, before I begin, that's also my disclaimer that I'm not a Sanskritist or a textualist, I'm an art historian. I'd also like to say a few words of thanks and gratitude to the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies for the conference and for extending the invitation for me to present my work to you. And I'd like to thank Himanshu Pravare.
We'll convey that
for extending again this invitation. I'm quite honored to be presenting my work to such esteemed an audience here. Okay. Hindu temples have long been recognized as places of transcendence, places where human worshippers can come into contact with a deity. The very nature of rock-cut architecture heightens this experience as the worshipper proceeds from a brightly lit earthly realm to a place of diffused light located deep inside a mountain. Sculptural programs carved on the exterior and interior of these monuments also contribute to the divine environment of the cave temple. Representations of various celestials, such as heavenly musicians and loving couples, along with depictions of specific deities, clearly demarcate the temple as a place of residence for the gods. While notions of the temple as a divine residence have been explored in regard to Hindu rock-cut temples, similar studies have not been conducted for Jain monuments. One reason for this neglect may be the simple fact that the liberated Jinnah is not considered to be present within the main shrine image, and so the temple is not thought of as a residence per se. Though this is technically the case, similarities between Hindu and Jain rock-cut monuments in terms of imagery and the designation of sacred space suggest more nuanced connections. In this paper, I examine the similarities and differences between Hindu and rock-cut monuments, between Hindu and Jain rock-cut monuments in terms of imagery and the designation of sacred space. I'll be focusing on two rock-cut monuments at the site of Ellora, one being the Kailasanatha temple, which is probably known to everyone, as well as a lesser-known Jain temple, which is nicknamed the Chota Kailasa. As its appellation suggests, the Chota Kailasa resembles the site's larger Hindu temple in terms of its execution and architectural components. A close examination of these two monolithic rock-cut temples will shed light on how notions of the divine or liberated are articulated, and what this may mean in the early medieval temple setting. In addition, an analysis of the visual evidence at Ellora will provide a better understanding of notions of presence, absence, and residence in early medieval Hindu and Jain practice. Perhaps one of the most dramatic expressions of the temple as divine residence is Ellora's Kailasanatha temple, which you see here. Dedicated to the Hindu god Shiva, this monolithic rock-cut temple presents the god in his mountain abode. The temple's towering vimana, which was originally painted white like a Himalayan peak, pierces the sky above the double-story gateway that precedes the temple complex. Carved on this gateway and on its attached screen wall are numerous forms of Shiva, the gods Brahma and Kartikeya, various avatars of Vishnu, directional deities, river goddesses, and Nagas. These figures convey the power and expansive nature of the Hindu pantheon and clearly demarcate the worshipper's initial transition from secular to sacred space. Moreover, many of these deities are replicated within the galleries spanning the rear and side walls of the temple courtyard. These over life-sized figures are carved in deep relief and include representations of Shiva and Vishnu. Like the deities on the gateway, the gods carved within the galleries are framed by narrow pilasters that visually present them as part of a continuous series. Thus, the gateway and gallery deities form a protective ring or boundary around the temple and clearly establish the Kailasanatha as a realm of the gods. While the numerous Hindu deities that encircle the temple proper contribute to the celestial setting of the monument, other reliefs on the temple itself further define this divine abode as Lord Shiva's Himalayan retreat. And I have a few of these images in the longer paper, so I don't want to spend too much time discussing them here, but this is probably the most famous or most literal presentation of Shiva on Mount Kailasa. Didn't want to go that fast with it. He is seated here with Parvati, and Ravana is here below, right, shaking Mount Kailasa, and Shiva is able to sort of quell this disturbance by placing his foot solidly on the ground. This relief, really it's more of a tableau, is about 14 feet in height, so it's a very monumental image, and it's on the south side of the mandapa, so it would be the last colossal image that one would see before entering into the temple proper. Other images that relate specifically to Himalayan topography mentioned in the paper include the shrine to the river goddesses, dedicated to Ganga, Yamuna, and Saraswati. Ganga, who you see on the right, is carved here in the center, sort of on axis to the stairs. And as I also mentioned, this is important because it's on the north side of the temple complex, and when one enters after going through the gateway, this would be the first shrine one could visit during pradakshina around the temple. So we have this sense of a continuation of this theme of Shiva and this Himalayan topography, specifically with the Ganges here taking central position in the shrine. And then a final image also that relates this idea of the Kailasanatha being conceived as Shiva's mountain abode is a large relief of Shiva receiving the Ganga, the Ganges River, personified here, through his locks of hair. And I also discuss in the paper how when she touches his locks of hair, the stream sort of branches off into two streams or rivers here, one seemingly coming down to touch the earth, the other winding its way around this seated ascetic, and then forming a waterfall that drops into this sort of rocky outcrop. And there seems to be some visual play here with the natural grottos and things that I discussed and mentioned Walter Smith's work on this site, the natural grottos that are located to the north of the Kailasanatha temple that seem to serve this idea of an ascetic setting or grove. While the Kailasanatha temple is Ellora's most well-known monument, a Jain monolithic temple, nicknamed the Chota Kailasa, is also carved at the site. And for most of these images, the Chota Kailasa, will be, images from the Chota Kailasa will be featured on the right-hand side. So what we're looking at is the Hindu Kailasanatha temple and the Jain Chota Kailasa, both shots taken from the northeastern corner. Like its Hindu counterpart, the Chota Kailasa is created by carving three trenches into the mountain to isolate a large block of stone. The courtyard of the Chota Kailasa measures approximately 130 by 80 feet, or about one-third of the size of the Hindu monument. In addition, work on both temples proceeded from the top down, a technique which is clearly demonstrated on the southeast side of the Chota Kailasa, where lower parts of the Vimana are left unfinished. In addition to the similarities in their excavation process, these two temples feature some of the same architectural components: a rock-cut gateway, which you can see here, a main hall, a mandapa with projecting porches, a pyramidal Vimana, and then they also have excavations carved in the sides of the enclosure walls. The overall design of both temples clearly suggests that these monuments function as self-contained celestial abodes. Their excavation deep into the mountain itself adds to this experience. According to both Hindu and Jain Puranic literature, celestial structures are typically located at the summit of Mount Meru, the Golden Peak, the beginning of the heavens. At Ellora, trees and other types of foliage grow along the edges of the enclosure walls of both temples, creating the illusion that the monolithic structure emerges from beneath this vegetation. Furthermore, both temples have access to water, the life-sustaining and ritually purifying liquid that originates from the heavens. All of these elements, subsidiary shrines, enclosed courtyards, trees, and pools of water, are common features of celestial structures described in Hindu and Jain literature. Moreover, these elements correspond to the components of later structural medieval temples, which further develop the conception of the temple as a divine structure made manifest on earth. Comparisons can also be made with the arrangement and design of the Mandapa pillars. Both temples have 16 pillars that are carved in groups of four. And on the left is the plan of the Kailasanatha, and these are the Mandapa pillars. And this is Jose Pereira's plan of the Chota Kailasa, demonstrating this same arrangement. This arrangement creates a major and minor axis within the hall. The main axis leads from the primary or west entrance to the shrine carved in the back wall. The minor or secondary axis leads to the two side porches of each monument. This arrangement allows for the greatest amount of light to permeate the dark interior, and it provides an unobstructed view and pathway to the main shrine. Of significance, the other 9th century Jain cave temples at Ellora do not exhibit this arrangement. Thus, the replication of the Kailasanatha's interior space in the Chota Kailasa was a conscious choice, and it cannot be explained away as a standard excavation technique. Moreover, the attenuated, streamlined proportions of the pillars in the Kailasanatha and Chota Kailasa contrast greatly to those carved in contemporary Hindu and Jain caves at the site, such as the Lankeshvara temple and a group of Jain caves known collectively as the Indra and Jagannatha Sabha. What you're looking at here on the left is a view of the pillars of the Chota Kailasa compared to the remaining Jain caves, the more common pillar type found in the those other excavations, Jain ones, that also are very similar to those carved in the Lankeshvara temple. It seems clear that the artists carving the pillars for the monolithic temples preferred a more slender design to continue and further the illusion of the structural, quote-unquote, structural nature of the monuments, an illusion that is created initially by their exteriors. While the general similarities between these two monuments have been recognized by scholars, far too often the Chota Kailasa has been simply dismissed as a poorer, later imitation of its Hindu counterpart. Moreover, any shared features have only been considered in terms of providing a 9th century date for the majority of Ellora's Jain monuments. Any inquiry into why some of the Kailasanatha's visual forms were appropriated by the Jains has not yet been conducted. This is unfortunate, as some of the shared imagery found on the exterior of the monuments reveal similar conceptions in creating a divine and celestial setting. Apart from their architectural components, the strongest visual link between these two monuments lies in the exterior decoration of their mandapas. Carved as a running frieze along the temple's entablature, for example, is a band of frolicking gunas who hold an undulating garland. Some of the gunas support the garland over their head, while others recline on it. The composition is rhythmic and playful and serves to integrate the architectural and decorative features on the temple's exterior. Although gunas are a featured facade element in a number of caves at Ellora, including the Hindu caves number 17 and 21, their presentation within a band that encircles the temple is found in only these two cases. Of significance, it does not appear on the other two monolithic monuments at Ellora, the Nandi Pavilion that precedes K-15 and the Jain Sarvatobhadra Temple in the Indra Sabha Courtyard. Another sculptural motif that is shared by the Chota Kailasa and the Kailasanatha Temple is the carving of flying celestial figures, located particularly on the northern and southern walls of the mandapas. It is, however, not the mere inclusion of such figures that draws comparison, but in the way that they are presented on both temples. For example, the flying figures are carved high up on the wall and are framed by pilasters. In both temples, the figures are somewhat isolated from other kinds of imagery, underscoring the plain surfaces of the temple walls. This presentation also reinforces the illusion that the celestials are actually flying through space. Interestingly, the Kailasanatha temple has more individual flying figures than the Jain temple, which tends to feature couples. Nonetheless, in both cases, the position of the limbs of these figures suggests rapid flight. Now, another type of imagery that's also similar in these two temples are carvings that are found on the porch eaves. Here's the south side of the Kailasanatha temple. Has these sort of scrolls of foliage and sort of motifs of water and cascades of sort of vegetation that are carved here on these corners of the porch eaves. And we can see that there are similar carvings on the Chota Kailasa. And even if there are not finished, we have the matrix of stone that's still left intact for this type of carving. And here is sort of a detail of two figures. Sometimes we find makaras who are also carved here, and they seem to be sort of swirling in within their body, sort of dissolve into this sort of vegetation and foliage that sort of surrounds them. And it's kind of interesting when we think about these motifs and their location on the porch eaves, because the porches themselves are sort of seen as this extension or growth from the mandapa, and we get this same sense of movement and abundance and fecundity also reinforced here on the outside, the design here of the porch eaves. Now, while the images of gunas, flying celestials, and aquatic or vegetal designs may be considered minor motifs, they are nonetheless important elements that define the aesthetic nature of these two monuments. Their inclusion on the temple exterior creates the appropriate prelude to coming into contact with the divine housed deep inside the mountain. They assist in establishing the temple as a heavenly residence on earth. In the case of the Kailasanatha temple, this abode is undoubtedly Shiva's residence on Mount Kailasa in the Himalayas. But in the case of the Chota Kailasa, whose residence is made visually manifest? Unlike the Kailasanatha and its visual references to Shiva and Himalayan topography, the exterior of the Chota Kailasa does not feature images of jinnas as we might expect. Moreover, considering that all 24 jinnas exist in a state of perfected liberation at the apex of the universe, rather than in a heavenly realm, we must ask ourselves whether or not we can conceive of the Jain temple as a residence for the jinnah in a similar way that we do for a Hindu temple and its god. Two reliefs flanking the entrance into the Chota Kailasa may assist us in answering this query. Carved under the porch cornice are two over life-sized dancing figures. And I've just provided one on the right here, and then this image here is in context. The other image is on the other side of this porch entrance here. While these figures are commonly misidentified as representations of dancing Shiva, and I kind of go into why these aren't in the longer paper, and this identification, of course, has sort of perpetuated the nickname of this temple as the Chota Kailasa. The images are, in actuality, representations of Indra. Though Indra is an important deity in Hindu art and literature, this god plays a particularly interesting role in a Jain context. In Jain textual and artistic productions, Indra often serves as an active participant during the five auspicious events of a Tirthankara's final lifetime: conception, birth, initiation, attainment of omniscience, and final liberation. Indra also plays a significant role during the jinnah's first sermon. After attaining omniscience, a jinnah delivers a sermon in a divine celestial hall called a Samavasarana. In most texts, this hall is described as a vast circular or square structure that has an elevated pavilion at its center. It is, however, in southern Digambara texts where Indra's special role in the Samavasarana is highlighted. According to Jinnasena's Adi Purana, Indra is the chief architect of the jinnah's celestial assembly hall. Although other deities join in to help him build the sacred structure, they do so under his command and guidance. Upon seeing the completed Samavasarana, the gods rejoice in song and dance. Indra himself is accompanied by a large group of dancing goddesses who slowly make their way into the assembly hall. Similar dance performances are recorded in two medieval Tamil Puranas, the Sri Purana and the Meru Mandara Purana. And according to T.N. Ramachandran's assessment of these texts, Indra dances out of joy at the conclusion of the Jinnah's sermon. In addition, Indra asks the Tirthankara to preach the doctrine to devotees in other parts of the world that are in need of instruction. Thus, Indra acts as a facilitator to guarantee the continuation of Ajina's teachings after the dissolution of the Samavasarana. Now, the inclusion of these reliefs of dancing Indra on the facade of the Chota Kailasa is also interesting in light of the fact that they are later additions to the temple. Although the Chota Kailasa is an early 9th century temple, the facade reliefs most likely date to the late 9th or early 10th century. The reliefs of Indra are incised into the wall, which is especially evident around their heads, suggesting that they were carved after the initial excavation of the temple. This has resulted in their rather planar appearance, which contrasts the full-bodied Dvarapalas and the flying figures carved elsewhere on the exterior of the monument. In addition, these carvings appear to replicate two 9th century Jain paintings that are located on the antechamber ceiling of two prominent caves in what is known as the Indrasabha complex. These paintings feature a dancing Indra, who is also accompanied by musicians and smaller celestial couples that hover over his shoulder. This is the best preserved of the two paintings. Again, this is in an antechamber ceiling, and I'll point it out because it's a little hard to see the figure of Indra and his multiple limbs. You can see some of his long hair behind here and his crown. And you see some of the musicians here as well. And then he's also got these little couples that kind of dance over his shoulders, very similar to that. Of significance, these paintings are part of a larger artistic program that presents the shrine Jinnah surrounded by lay and monastic devotees, gods, and animals. As I have presented and published elsewhere, these programs transform the shrine chamber of these two caves into a three-dimensional Samavasarana. And just to say it briefly, you can see here in these compartments are images of monks, you have some nuns, laymen and laywomen, gods and goddesses, and then in the final compartment here is a series of animals. So really, again, making this shrine chamber now conceptualized here as the Jinnah seated within this celestial assembly hall, within this Samavasarana, and the paintings of dancing Indra, who dances both before and after the creation of this celestial assembly hall, is painted right up here on the ceiling. Through a detailed examination of the imagery of Ellora's Chota Kailasa, it seems clear that conceptions of the Samavasarana played a significant role in the design and later modifications to this temple. Again, what we see is a transformation. Not only is the shrine chamber and those other caves are three-dimensional Samavasaranas, but the addition of the Indras here on the outside of the Chota Kailasa now transform the entire temple into this Samavasarana. Of significance, Ellora's visual expressions are early manifestations of this concept, which is developed even further in later medieval Jain art and literature. Indeed, by the 13th and 14th centuries, the Samavasarana becomes the prototypical model for understanding and experiencing the Jain temple. By equating the temple with the Samavasarana, the devotee is able to enter, albeit momentarily, into the presence of the preaching Jinnah. Through a process of mental projection, the worshiper becomes a part of the audience who has gathered to hear the Tirthankara's first sermon. Thus, the specific celestial setting of the Chota Kailasa heightens a sense of presence, even though the liberated Jinnah is technically inaccessible to the worshiper. And I think that this interest in establishing a sense of presence may have been fueled in part by the visual impact of the Kailasanatha temple, as it can be considered the most dramatic expression of divine residence at the site. Both the Chota Kailasa and the Kailasanatha temple present their respective sacred beings in a celestial environment, in an environment that assists the worshiper in making contact with that divine presence. This interest is expressed in visual terms through the many shared elements in these two temples. Indeed, the similar employment of gunas, flying celestials, and other motifs, not to mention the nearly identical demarcation of sacred space, suggests a broader South Asian interest in articulating and establishing divine presence. At the same time, however, other types of imagery carved on these monuments indicate that conceptions of presence and their visual expression are specific to each tradition. While further investigations are needed, this initial examination should prompt us to consider Hindu and Jain artistic and devotional interactions at Ellora and at other multi-religious sites. And more importantly, we need to consider how these interactions may have affected the creation and conception of temple architecture in South Asia. Thank you.
Well, we have three or four minutes for two or three questions. Quickly.
At the base of the dancing Indra, we're not very clear. Were they musicians?
Yes.
Yes.
Mostly drummers.
Right.
In the paper, you
go ahead.
In the paper, you talk about these Sarvatu Bhadra images.
Oh, yes.
Which means four-faced images. That's in the Chota Kailasa?
It's not in the Chota Kailasa. I think I'm going to just take a second because I know I don't have too much time. I think I have.
That's a Sarvatu Bhadra type of temple.
This one is in front of the Indra Sabha complex, so there is one of these sort of Sarvatu Bhadra temples there. Mm-hmm. But in the Chota Kailasa itself, I talked about mostly the amount of, the temple itself lacks images of jinnas on the outside, but once you enter inside the temple, the entire wall space is covered with jinnas, which is very unusual because some of the other cave temples have this Jain Yaksha couple oftentimes in there. But the Chota Kailasa, the interior sculptures are all jinnas. So you get the sense of being surrounded by them. It's almost the same way as this emanating presence that these four adorse jinnah images do. So I kind of tied that in conceptually with these Sarvatu Bhadra images, that same idea of this emanation all around in all directions occurs. Which is what you get in this one.
Just look up and you've got these faces with arches spewing down in a sequence in the distance. Emanating.
Yeah, constantly, yeah.
Going on to my talk.
Going out. That's what we should. Nothing was demonstrated.
Sorry.
Yeah. No, it's a good prelude.
One more? Yes,
please. I suppose one has to ask the good old Hinduization thesis, you know, what is your view on that with regard to the Jain?
Well, I think that the Kailasanatha, that temple itself, certainly made an impact on both the artists who were working there and the local community. And so creating another temple for the Jains and borrowing a lot of the specific imagery, which, again, isn't found in other cave monuments at the site, implies, again, this impact of this idea of presence. And because I would consider the Kailasanatha being the most dramatic expression of these ideas, that when the artists were carving this Jain temple, it was kind of tapping into this, again, this idea of presence, but now changing the form subtly so it fits the Jain religious tradition by incorporating this idea of the jinn and then being accessible because he's in the Soma Vasadana, because that's a moment where we can sort of interact and engage with the jinn once he's preaching his first sermon. So using sort of the vocabulary of presence drawn from the Kailasanatha and applying it here to a Jain context.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.